tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The district attorney in Sacramento, California is suing the city over homelessness. CBS's Matt Piper.
Prosecutor Tin Ho is suing Sacramento's city leaders over homeless encampments after he says he asked them to enforce laws over sidewalks overrun by tents.
The unhoused are living in conditions typical of third world countries. All the while, the rest of the community is stuck between compassion and chaos.
Steve Berg is with the National Alliance to End Homelessness.
I feel like it's a community that in the past has tried to get everybody together around the issue of homelessness, and it seems like that's not happening now.
Business owners say they've spent thousands on security systems, while homeowners say they've been threatened with guns at their front doors. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Ukraine's president urges the entire world to unite against Russia's aggression.
It is not only about Ukraine.
President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking before the UN General Assembly, saying Russia's war against Ukraine is affecting the entire world, pointing, for example, to Russian missile attacks against Ukrainian port cities.
It is a clear Russia's attempt to weaponize the food shortage on the global market.
Mr. Zelensky also said if allowed to continue, Russian aggression will not stop with Ukraine. He told member nations it will be used against all of yours as well. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, Washington.
Escalating tensions after Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announces his country is investigating allegations that Indian government's agents assassinated Hardeep Singh Nijjar, a Sikh leader in British Columbia. Trudeau saying today,
"We are not looking to provoke or escalate. We are simply laying out the facts as we understand them, and we want to work with the government of India."
But India has expelled a senior Canadian diplomat and is accusing Canada of interfering in its internal affairs. Hunter Biden's attorneys are asking a Delaware court to allow the president's son to not have to appear in person for his first hearing. CBS's Catherine Harris.
Hunter Biden's attorney wants his initial court appearance by video conference, citing excessive security costs and the precedent set during the COVID-19 lockdowns. His legal team says the government's opposition to their request is puzzling because they say Hunter Biden is not asking for special treatment.
The United Auto Worker strike is in its fifth day. Union members, including Kurt Kruger, have been walking the picket line outside Stellantis' Toledo, Ohio plant.
We want to know what's happening with the other plants. We want promises, too, on, transferring over to EV. So we don't want to be left behind in that.
The union is threatening strikes at more plants by noon Friday. Stocks slip on Wall Street. This is CBS News.
You need to hire fast and hire right? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. The man convicted of killing Rusk County Deputy Dan Glaze 7 years ago will not have his appeal reviewed by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. According to a WQOW report, Doug Nitek's conviction and life sentence will stand after the Wisconsin Supreme Court announced they would not review the case. Nitek was arrested the morning after law enforcement officers found the body of Deputy Glaze in his car on October 29, 2016. With abortion services being offered in the state again, University Health Systems will once again begin referring University of Wisconsin-Madison students to in-state clinics for abortion services. According to a Daily Cardinal report, University Health Systems had been forced to refer students to out-of-state clinics after the U.S. Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade in June of 2022. Last week, a Wisconsin judge ruled the 1849 law that could have banned abortions did not apply to consensual abortions. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
The Cripes Cast with Charlie Behrens.
Today, I am talking to the owner of Funky Fresh Spring Rolls, my friend Truman McGee. From an environmentally friendly perspective, The fact that it's frozen means that it's not going to waste.
I'm a cereal strawberry abuser. If you're a fruit and you're watching this, stay away from me, okay? Do not jump in my shopping cart because I will let you die.
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
Lopez Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Brock.
I didn't realize that Tucker Carlson's like hemorrhaging viewers. And I heard yesterday someone was like, oh yeah, like no one's actually watching it anymore. I was like, oh, yeah, that doesn't really surprise me. It's kind of like Threads.
it was a thing for about 5 minutes.
It was
like
a week. Everyone was excited and then they moved on.
Well, it's like Scott Walker's presidential campaign. It's a big deal for about a week.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed. Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
Or talking points. We don't work for them and we never will. I'm Rick Smith and I work for you. Join us daily at therickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Republicans unfurled their budget proposal, the blueprint, the grand moral document, the statement of their values. And guess what it said? I had prepared this whole thing and I'm going, you know, should I bother? Should I bother going through the fact that they're proposing trillions of dollars of federal spending cuts over the next decade under the guise of screw the poor? I mean, because where are they going to cut? Well, they're going to cut Medicaid. You know, got to get those poor people to work, especially those old people in nursing homes. Going to cut the federal programs for nutrition, SNAP benefits. We're going to make hungry people hungrier. Yeah, that's the good God-fearing Christian way to go. They want to establish, and this is kind of new, the House Budget Committee Republicans want to establish, how did they put it, a bipartisan debt commission. Oh boy, Simpson Bowles, here we come. And they're going to examine and propose ideas on how to change, quote, the drivers of U.S. debt, you know, like Social Security and Medicare. Could you be any more transparent? These are the same people who, you remember when Mike Lee and the rest of them were, when Biden accused them of wanting to cut Social Security, they're like, who, us? Really? No, we would never, no, not us. We swear we, not us. And yet, in writing. Now, the convenient little fact that Social Security does nothing to the federal deficit. By law, it doesn't add to the federal deficit. But never mind. Don't get in the way of a good ideological talking point wanting to destroy Social Security, because that's, again, what Republicans are going after. They also want to cut, what is it, something like $5 trillion in discretionary spending over the next decade. And like I said, you know, our good God-fearing Republican friends are going to cut mandatory spending. Again, that's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, by nearly $9 trillion. Oh, I'm sorry, they're not cutting. They're saving. They're going to save all of these trillions of dollars by stealing from poor people and working class folks. They're going to cut the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. We're going to take that by about, what, $800 billion? They want to gut that. So, again, more hungry people. $2 trillion they want to cut from Medicaid. And then they want to add a work requirement. And look, I'm not opposed to a work requirement if there's a job. So, I said this during the Clinton years when welfare reform came out and they said, well, everyone's going to have to go to work. And that's great. where are they going to work? And I've been saying for the longest time, I'm in favor of a work requirement if government then becomes the employer of last resort. He says, look, you know, because I do believe there's some positive things in work. There's some self-esteem. There's a bunch of good stuff that comes out of, you know, doing a day's work and earning your way. But, you know, I also grew up in an area that wasn't on a bus line and there were no jobs around. And good luck finding those good, high-paying jobs in a place where there are none. So for me, this is one of those things where I know it's their ideological talking point, and I don't really mean it. It's just a way to beat up on poor people. But it's infuriating. And what we know is these savings, because they're going to save us trillions of dollars, so they say. We know these are going to hurt households that are low and moderately low income homes. These are going to hurt lower working class folks. The working poor are going to get just slammed if this were to ever become law. And it's not going to. But this is my problem with this. This is their messaging bill. This is the messaging bill. This is the message that they're sending to voters that, hey, we don't care about working people. And as we know, there are going to be massive cuts to public funding because that's what they want. They want to gut education. They want to gut medical research. They want to gut the EPA. They want to gut Social Security. They've been saying this for years. So are we surprised? No. They want to gut the Obamacare. And again, you know, this is who they are. And was it Maya Angelou when said, who, you know, when someone tells you who they are, believe them? Well, believe them. Because not only are they talking about slashing and burning programs that help people who are struggling near the bottom of the economic ladder, they're also talking about, you know, more tax cuts that we know just worsens inequality and guts our ability to fund the things that we need. And again, this comes back to my Republican friends hating working people. This is easy. This is easy to hate on the less fortunate and the struggling. But understand, this is a messaging bill. And who is the message for? Well, the message is for campaign donors. It's for the very wealthy. It's for the CEO class. It's for, you know, the people that, you know, fund their campaigns. Which is why I found it interesting that Nikki Haley weighed in on the UAW strike. And again, look, Nikki Haley is someone who hates workers, hates unions. In fact, at a Walmart shareholders meeting once said that the reason she wears pointy toes is so she can kick unions where they hurt, because South Carolina has the lowest unionization rate. So she would be thrilled to see all the jobs come to South Carolina with poverty wages and desperate conditions because, hey, ideologically, she's in line with it. But she went on TV today. And this is one of those weird moments where I'm really not sure where, if this is a, you know, a Joe Biden endorsement or if this is the dog whistle. Now, understand, as I said about the Republican messenger bill, she's talking to a specific audience. And working people, that is not the audience that she's talking to. So here was Nikki Haley on the F channel. You got to hear this. So here's the wannabe next president, the wannabe potential vice presidential poll. Here's Nikki Haley.
Well, I think that's it tells you that when you have the most pro-union president and he touts that he is emboldening the unions, this is what you get. And I'll tell you who pays for it is the taxpayers. You know, here from what I understand, the union is asking for a 40% raise. You know, the companies have come back with a 20% raise. I think any of the taxpayers would love to have a 20% raise and think that's great. But, you know, the problem is we're all going to suffer from this. This is going to cost things to go up. And, you know, this is going to last a while. But, you know, when you have a president that's constantly saying, go union, go union, this is what you get. The unions get emboldened and then they start asking for things that, you know, that companies have a tough time doing. And so I don't think government should get involved in this. These are private sector matters. But I do think the tone of how a president talks about unions and how a president emboldens them does play a role in this. And we're seeing what Biden has done play a role in this.
And I'm with her. Oddly enough, I agree. This is Biden's doing. This is Biden promoting a very pro-union message. saying, look, we want to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. We want to do better. We want to have better lives, better jobs. What I found interesting, though, is she's talking about, you know, the workers want a 40% raise. What she didn't bother mentioning at all, come to her lips, is that that number came from what the executives pocketed in the previous 4 years. So the people that she's talking to, the people that are important to her, the CEO class, they saw their incomes jump by 40% over the last 4 years. But working people demanding the same thing? Oh, no, no, no. Can't possibly have that. Now, as I said, she knows exactly who she's talking to. She knows the audience. And it's not the UAW members. It's not those auto workers. It's not the working people who have been struggling for years. It's the CEO class. It's the Mary Barras. It's the Tim Gurneys that we talked about last week. You know, we got to get those workers in their place. You know, put them and keep them back where they belong, in their place, desperate and, well, grateful. And this, again, is one of these weird moments where they're telling us, voting working people, they're telling you who they are. So why any working person would vote for these folks is well beyond my ability to comprehend. For instance, Donald Trump says he's going to go to Detroit to talk to the auto workers. He's going to walk the picket line. And good on him. It's a smart thing to do. But this is a guy who, while courting the UAW, is saying, well, your leadership has sold you out. And, you know, it's bad. And he, again, is on the side of the CEOs. Now, the union president, and good on him, this is the right frame. He said, look, every fiber of our union is being poured into fighting the billionaire class and an economy that enriches people like Donald Trump at the expense of workers. Now, this is what I've been saying for years. This is not new, but this is finally someone saying it in a position of power, going, hey, he's the problem. And look, I love his response, because what we talk about here on the show, this is an up-down response in the world that tries to keep pushing workers into the red hat, blue hat fight. That's what this really is. And you say, look, this is about taking on billionaires. This is about taking on an economy that's rigged against we, the working people. And Trump is part of that world. He doesn't mention Democrats. He doesn't mention Republicans. He doesn't get into red hat, blue hat, which is smart. What he talks about is, we're going to take on the wealth class. This is class warfare. And as Warren Buffett said, his class is winning, but they shouldn't be. For instance, today's big story. In fact, the big story for the last 2 days has been suits being worn in the Senate. This is the big story. This is the outrage. How dare John Fetterman wear shorts? Not that he would wear shorts in the Senate, but evidently doing away with the dress code is all John Fetterman's fault. And what's interesting to me, again, this is one of those weird things, is you got Joe Manchin who jumps into the middle of this. And it's been reported that Joe Manchin says, I think John, it's wrong. He said, I think John, it's wrong. There's no way I can comply with that. Wanted to tell him directly that I opposed it and will do everything I can do to hold the decorum of the Senate. Let that sink in for 1 second, because this is the guy who cast the deciding vote to cause more pain and suffering for children in this country, more than doubled childhood poverty, because in his well-tailored suit, in his $1,000 plus suit, he cast a vote to literally take food out of the mouths of children. If this weren't terrestrial radio, I think you know what the two-word response to him would be from me. But I can't say it. So I suggest you call him and tell him. Because I'm sure those children were so thrilled to know that the food that's not on their table was taken away by a guy, at least in a suit. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Got a couple emails that caught my attention. One of them was Rick, I heard your rant about Drew Barrymore and thought you should know that in 2004, Donald Trump crossed a picket line of the Writers Guild in New York City. The Writers Guild were on strike. The workers at The Apprentice were demanding to get paid fairly, and Trump did nothing. Trump did nothing and crossed their line. He is the most anti-worker, anti-union president in U.S. history, and a scab. Thought you should know. Thanks for your show. It's brilliant. Bryce. Understand. Yeah. Hello. Donald Trump is most certainly a scab in these situations. There's no surprise in that. It is what it is. Also want to get to Janet in Minneapolis. Janet says, I agree with your assessment that conservatives are horrible parents. What are we teaching our children? Donald Trump is dishonest, cruel, arrogant, delusional, greedy, vulgar, obnoxious, and bullying. Wow. Can you throw some more in there? Putting him back in the White House will teach our children all the wrong lessons about what being a good person and good citizen means. This is an absolute tragedy that so many people support this man. Yeah, no kidding. Okay, I'm with you, Janet. Appreciate the thoughts and the call. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Insane as usual. So, what I wanted to say was, you absolutely have to love, and I'm being sarcastic here, Manchin. You know, his daughter had ran Mylan there for a long time in Morgantown, West Virginia. And she's the one that raised the price on those EpiPens where they were like $2,000-$3,000.
Yeah, I remember.
So, you know, he's actually a Democrat in name only. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he'd switch over to being a Republican, you know, like Jim Justice did there in West Virginia. But who cares whether or not someone is dressed in a suit or if they are wearing something relaxable and they're making the laws?
Yeah, I got to tell you, though.
Because apparently.
Yeah, I'm of the side they should wear suits. I mean, I'm on that side. You know, you don't wear a hoodie into the Senate. I'm on that side. But for Joe Manchin to speak
up. Well, my thing, though, is this. Quite frankly, they could wear a bikini or Speedos as long as they do their damn job.
Okay, I'm with you there.
But
here's the thing. Susan Collins said she's going to wear a bikini. Do you really want to see Susan Collins in a bikini?
I think she'd probably wear one of the swim dresses. But, you know, this is what the Republicans do.
Yeah.
Instead of doing their job, making reasonable laws instead of going, oh, no, we have to give everything to the wealthy because they're special, and they aren't. The wealthy are generally just those who are a bit more crooked and smarter at it than anybody else. But that's what they do.
Yeah.
They, you know, make a big thing out of something stupid or make up a lies and propaganda or take something and just blow it out of proportion to take the heat off the fact that they aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Exactly. It's all about the bread and circus and the distraction. Appreciate the thoughts, Alice. Got to move along. Let's go to David in Milwaukee on line two. David, how are you today?
Not too bad. Hanging in there.
I just really wanted to touch base with you on what you were talking about yesterday, if you don't mind for a second, about the UAW, and you had a guest on last night.
Right.
I should just mention to you, so obviously, if you're aware, Wisconsin used to make a lot of cars, a lot of trucks, and, you know, subsequently, we don't have any more manufacturing facilities anymore. We used to have the AMC plant in Kenosha, gone. They had a lot of union jobs over there. Janesville, Wisconsin, used to make a lot of GM trucks there. That's gone. It's just announced today that the UAW is going to probably lose the automotive plant that makes parts for Mopar and Bayview, which is a kind of like a neighborhood in the south side of Milwaukee. Another 100 union jobs going bye-bye. And so my point is this. You know, one of the things, the reason why the UAW is fighting, and just to bring this to your attention, the only reason why I know this is because I used to work for Chrysler many years ago, is that the gasoline-powered cars are very profitable, okay? We're now being forced and being switched into electric vehicles, which are huge money losers. And what I mean by that is, you talked about the Ford Lightning, you know, the truck.
Right.
That is a horrible truck. It can't tow a boat more than 70 miles, which is ridiculous. And the amount of time to recharge it, I mean, your weekend's over with. So the point is this, be careful what you wish for, because I do remember when Wisconsin had a lot of automotive jobs. And what they're going to do is, with the UAW, what's going to happen here is, and keep this in mind, with electric cars, you don't have moving parts, per se. There's going to be literally, Ford and GM have laid off thousands of workers already prior to this strike, just for the record. And Ford is losing their rear end on the electric vehicles. And it's the only reason why they haven't gone defunct is because, if you know, with the amount of money that the federal government has allocated to make electric cars, is what's keeping them artificially afloat. So I thought I'd bring that to your attention, because it's there's going to be a lot of UAW people are going to be out of a job when this is all said and done.
Yeah, and but this is going to this is what they're fighting for, is that next generation of jobs. That's what one of the big
yeah,
sticking
but the
points
next generation
here is
of jobs,
also,
unfortunately, is not going to exist.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to need people who are going to put those cars together, and they're going to be UAW folks, is what the argument is. This stuff is going to happen regardless of the unions involved or not. Those job losses in Wisconsin, corporate America made those decisions. They moved to much cheaper areas than you could probably even do in the U.S. So the question is when do we say enough is enough, and when do we put our foot down as a country? So I get your point, and I know what you're talking about, but corporate America is going to do this stuff to us anyway. It's our job to stand up and fight back in those moments. So, but
well,
I appreciate your thoughts, David. I appreciate. No, it's and look, I get this. You know, there were union jobs in a lot of the Rust Belt states that provided good wage jobs, that provided communities with revenue. And these corporations made choices to abandon those places. And we as consumers didn't bother to hold them accountable. We as consumers didn't, well, yeah, well, it's cheaper. You know, he talked about Janesville and the GM plant. They were making the Chevy Suburban both there and in Monterrey, Mexico, I believe it was at the time, before the Janesville plant closed down. No one bothered to check the VIN numbers when they were buying the Suburbans to find out where it was made. I did. You know, 145, the first number of the VIN number on a car, is made in the U.S. Two is made in Canada. The other numbers are other countries around the world. And we as consumers just wanted the cheapest stuff. And we basically screw those working people. I'm hoping we're at a moment where we start thinking differently. Because that argument is the one that the right makes all the time. Well, you know, if you ask too much. If you working people ask for, you know, a living wage, if you ask for health insurance, if you ask for retirement, if you ask for some say in what the next generation of manufacturing is going to look like, well, You could lose your situation. And this is what I talked about the other day with Jim Cramer. You know, Cramer said, well, if it were me, I would just move everything to Mexico and screw all of them. And you don't think the corporate CEOs have thought this through? You don't think that they're thinking that? And this is where we, working people, have to wake up and stop falling for the corporate line. Because that's the stuff they want us to feed into. You know, hey, I didn't have a choice. We had to fire all those workers. Our profits were sacrosanct. Because here's the thing. The big three have made $250 billion in profit off of the last 10 years. $250 billion. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1929. That was the day a mistrial was declared in the case of 16 textile mill unionists in North Carolina. The mistrial sparked 5 days of anti-union vigilante violence. Textile mill workers at Gastonia's Lorry Mill had been on strike since April 1st. They demanded higher wages and shorter work hours, union recognition, and an end to the hated stretch-out system. Soon, textile workers at Bessemer City's American Mill walked off the job in solidarity and joined the National Textile Workers Union. Ella Mae Wiggins was one of the strike leaders at American Mill. She was known for her militancy, but also for organizing black workers into the union. As the strike wore on, mill owners evicted dozens of families from company housing. Wiggins helped set up a tent city. On June 7th, sheriff's deputies attacked strikers who marched to Lorry Mill to call out remaining workers. The police arrived at the tent colony later that evening to disarm them, and Gastonia's police chief wound up dead. Immediately, more than 70 textile union members and leaders were rounded up and arrested. 16 stood trial for the murder of Chief Adderholt. The anti-union committee of 100 smashed up the NTWU headquarters in Gastonia and Bessemer City. They kidnapped, beat, and threatened to kill several union members. The rampage continued as SCAB forces moved on to Charlotte to raid the offices of the International Labor Defense, who had handled the strikers' case. 5 days into the terror, Wiggins was killed on her way to a union solidarity rally. Outrage over her murder forced mill owners to improve conditions and wages. But the fight to organize would continue for years. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Oh, thank God for Ted Cruz. Once again, the far right-wing U.S. Senator is saving you and me from a political horror that doesn't exist. This is Ted's specialty, for he seems unable to deal with the real economic and social problems that workaday people actually have. Thus, he constantly tries to divert attention from his senatorial incompetence by staging embarrassing political stunts, such as his furious fulminations against Big Bird, Mickey Mouse, and other fictional characters. Unable to triumph over them, however, Cruz is now conjuring up entirely fictional conflicts to let him, a Harvard-educated elitist, pose as a hero of working-class commoners. Beer drinkers, for example. The Cruiser recently swooped onto a Republican TV show squawking like Chicken Little that Joe Biden intended to restrict us Americans to only 2 beers a week. Oh, the horror! What is it with liberals that want to control every damn aspect of your life, squealed the senator, who, by the way, does want government to control every woman's reproductive rights, people's voting rights, the rights of labor, what books people can read, etc., etc. But Ted's in a tizzy over Biden's 2-beer limit. Only, there's no such thing. Actually, Biden has said nothing about beer. Zero, zilch. Joe's kinda busy. You know, Ukraine, global warming, healthcare, real problems. So, unlike the little senator from Texas, he doesn't have time to play political pickleball. This is Jim Hightower saying, embarrassingly, such other GOP officials as Iowa Senator Joni Ernst have joined Cruz's screwball crusade to stop Biden's non-existent beer bust. It's like they all went to clown school to learn to be senatorial. As for Ted, his nonstop series of nutty PR antics reveals that he is to a real senator what near beer is to beer, only not nearly as close.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, interesting story over at Bloomberg News. They're saying that money is leaving China at an alarming rate. In fact, the worst in almost a decade. And this means there's that investment is going somewhere. And the question is where? I mean, you look at home here, we're rebuilding some manufacturing, reshoring some stuff that we should have been never lost. There's some good opportunities here as the money is flowing out of China. They're struggling in this moment. And what's that going to mean? You know, how do they respond? And what's that mean for us? Is this, you know, the tariffs at work? Is this Biden's policy to reshore manufacturing? Or is it just there? It's time. That's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Glad to be with you as always.
So what do you make of this? Money's leaving the country. It's the, you know, the biggest outflow of capital. Which is saying investors are going somewhere else. Even homegrown investors are going elsewhere. Yeah. What do you make of this?
Yeah, well, I would say first, it's not surprising given some of the dynamics we've seen within Chinese politics and also what's been happening with respect to the economy. China never really got the response to COVID right. You know, first it was the complete lockdown, you know, zero COVID policy, and then they opened it back up. And I think that the economy is still reeling from that a little bit. But more importantly, and built up over time, is a fact that the way in which China's economy has grown is predicated on exports, basically, and attracting that investment in from foreign investors. Chinese citizens themselves don't consume a lot. They save a lot, in part because there's not a good social safety net. There's a lot of unpredictability, and especially since zero COVID and potentially having your income cut off, there's people are saving more, spending less. China has to find another way to grow. And what they turned to then, the Chinese government, was real estate investments. And there's been a whole spate of stories about that, about how these are going bad. So the writing's on the wall that something potentially not great could happen. And that means that capital is going to go elsewhere, and both multinational capital, as well as the folks who are able to invest and move money out of the country, who are Chinese citizens or companies themselves. And we've seen this already. I mean, I'm never going to be propping up Apple as a great example of anything. But, you know, Apple's, you know, the next generation of iPhones, some of those are being built in India rather than China. So it's making the move. And others are as well. So Xi Jinping obviously has some work to do to restore confidence in that. I'm not sure that that they'll get it done. This is going to have other consequences, yeah, of course, which we can talk about.
No, because I was going to ask you about, yeah, the consequences here, which you know, yeah, as we're moving towards electric vehicles, you know, I've been reading all these stories that, you know, China is just producing, you know, millions and millions of vehicles that they have no market for. So eventually, you know, they're going to try and dump them here and, yeah, and flood our market and destroy our market. Because, you know, I just had a caller a minute ago say that, you know, EV production is it's a money loser. Ford's losing its behind over the fact that they're investing in these EVs because, you know, they're not labor intensive and there's no profit on them. And there's that right wing view that this is a money loser. It's a money loser if China dumps millions of them into this country at you know, a tenth of the price.
Yeah, it sure is. And so that is exactly one of the consequences of this. I mean, the way in which China will seek to encourage growth is through its export policy. And this is what it's always done in the past: devalue its currency and ramp up its exports. And there's been really good evidence that that's been happening, particularly with respect to vehicles. And I saw a data point that was simply astounding to me, where China basically has 25 million new excess vehicles that will never be able to sell in China. You think about the size of our vehicle market in 1 year, the purchases maybe 13, 14, 15 million new cars. So you imagine 25 million excess cars just sitting there in China looking for an export market. Now, a lot of those are headed to Europe. Some of them are headed to Canada. Many of them are headed to other countries in Asia. We've seen very few come to the United States so far. And part of that is because we have a 25% tariff on Chinese electric vehicles right now. Part of that is because the incentives for people to buy electric vehicles, you know, if you're going to get the most bang for your buck as a consumer and get the whole $7,500, the car has to be made in America, of American parts. It can't be made in China. And so we actually, and Rick, I'm just saying this, for a change, we're kind of ahead of the curve on things here. Now, it may not always be that way. And you can bet that some people will be like, well, let's lower those tariffs. Let's get some of the Chinese autos in here, particularly the EVs. It'd be a huge mistake. Obviously, it would devastate the auto industry. And so what we need to do to respond to this is keep those tariffs on. We need to be on the lookout for attempts to evade that. We need to keep those made in America incentives in place. And we need to respond very quickly to other Chinese dumping as well that may occur in other sectors. So we're likely to see this not only in automobiles, but in other sorts of products that China makes. And we've seen what happens to American manufacturing. You know, we get devastated when we see this wave of Chinese dumping happen in the United States.
Yeah, but, you know, even still, I mean, there's the thought that, you know, a lot of the parts and a lot of the battery components and a lot of, you know, the things that go into the electric vehicle are sourced in China. And, you know, yeah. Tesla being at kind of the center of this. You know, because, you know, as I've heard, you know, they boast that they're, you know, not just an electric vehicle, but they're, you know, this marvel, they're ethical and all this stuff. And yet oddly silent on the Chinese sourcing.
Yeah. A marvel partially made with slave labor. Huh. Right. You know, that's the that's what Elon Musk is doing.
But isn't that the mock of the whole EV thing? I mean, you know, you get, you know, everyone's seen the videos out there that, you know, the lithium's, you know, being mined by children in the Congo, and, you know, all the sourcing is in, you know, desperate places, and you know, causing maybe, you know, even more environmental damage. Isn't that the argument against it?
Well, look, that is one of the arguments. I mean, there is responsibly sourced lithium. We're finding deposits in the United States. We need to scale up the ability to recycle all of these rare earth minerals as well. I think that's going to be important for success. But what we can't do is build a new vehicle foundation on slave labor. And unfortunately, some companies are more than willing to turn a blind eye when it helps them fill in their supply chain and deliver low costs. And there was a really, really important investigative piece done by Evan Halper, a Washington Post journalist, that built on research that's been done by some folks you know, Emily de la Briere and her colleague at Horizon Advisory, some researchers at Sheffield Hallam University, who've looked at Uyghur slave labor, and their conclusions are pretty bleak, is that not only Tesla, but other companies like Ford and Volkswagen may be turning a blind eye to real supply chain challenges that involve forced labor in China. And I hope the response to this, and I think this is part of what you're getting at, too. The answer is not to just say, well, we just have to keep the combustion engine forever. That is not the answer. The answer is to build out the supply chain responsibly and to understand that the sourcing of this really matters. We shouldn't just be trading like oil from the Saudis, which is despicable for a lot of people for human rights reasons, for EVs that have slave labor. I mean, that shouldn't be like the trade-off here. Right. No, we can do better than that.
And this is where I'll bring this to the UAW strike right now, because what they're talking about, one of the main sticking points is they want the next generation of manufacturing to be union jobs as they move away from the combustion engine and move toward EVs. Whether you're in favor of the move or not, I don't really care. They're saying, look, if the future is building these cars, we want auto workers who are unionized with good wages and benefits. We want them to build the next generation and ensure that they're ethically sourced. And we organize those workers down the line, so they're not slave laborers.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to go back even further, because I'll get to that point. But I'm going to go back even further because back during the Great Recession, when the auto companies were essentially insolvent, two out of three of them, right? And there was this rescue provided to them with some strings attached. The UAW had to take a big haircut too, and the workers had to take a big haircut along, and the companies are doing much better now, and they're investing in these EVs, and they're building some plants in states where there traditionally has been a UAW presence, and they're building some plants in states where it's a little harder to do that. But the most important thing is they're again getting federal money to do this, right? That there's a lot of resources available through the Inflation Reduction Act and what have you to build out these domestic supply chains. And so I think the UAW is right to demand more from the companies.
Yep.
After all, the companies are going to get taxpayer assistance for this transition to ensure that they can do that and remain competitive and be global leaders in this. The UAW must be made to feel the same way. And that's about sharing the wealth here and not taking the hit, because there will also be a massive jobs transformation.
Right.
The
buzzword being a just transition. As we're moving from one to another, the workers don't take it on the chin. And this is something I've talked about, quite extensively over the last year or two. As we move into robotics and AI and EVs and all of this new technology, I don't want this technological shift to be at the expense of working people and their standard of living. As every one of the past transitions has shown us, we should learn from the past and do differently going forward, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, there is an opportunity here, because some of these jobs, I mean, many of these jobs that are available should be good jobs, will require a slightly different skill set that probably in many cases merits better wages based on what's being brought to the table here. And so I do think that the UAW's right to raise these issues, right to demand responses from the legacy automakers so that they can be in this together. Because I think that if there is this collaboration and there is this recognition on the part of the companies that the UAW is a valued partner in this, it can be very successful. Right. And I would love to see the United States positioned as a global leader on all of this. Yeah, that's only going to be possible if the UAW is viewed as a valued partner and not as a cost center.
Not a negative on a spreadsheet. You're spot on right. Last question I've got for you, back to China. I saw this story that you guys have over at your website that actually stopped me dead in my tracks. One of the things we talk about quite often is, Chinese manufacturing and national security. Shipbuilding capacity, as was pointed out, evidently leaked, a leaked slide from a Navy briefing says that China has a capacity to build ships, 230 times greater than the U.S.? I mean, massive amounts more. Is this accurate?
Yeah, it is, unfortunately. It is indeed pretty terrifying. And again, you and I, we're not warmongers, but we need to be prepared. And the U.S. Navy has always had the reputation as being the best in the world and the most capable. But and yes, this Navy document showed that Chinese shipyards have 232 times the capacity than U.S. shipyards do. In fact, our capacity is so low, we can only put out a couple ships a year. You know, basically one aircraft carrier, if we're lucky, and a couple of other ships. And so we got to do better than that. And and this has commercial implications as well.
Yeah.
Why should all of the goods in the world be floating on ships that almost all of which are not made in the United States? Come on. You know, we got to invest in industries that are going to be important for our national security and for our future. Shipbuilding's one of those.
Yeah, I mean, 23,250,000 tons of capacity in China, 100,000 tons here. That is, you know, that's a lot of zeros. It's a lot of zeros. But Scott, I appreciate the time. Good stuff as always. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks, Rick. Great to be with you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much, our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that stuff. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Let's talk.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1977. That was the day that is remembered in Youngstown, Ohio, as Black Monday. The Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company announced plans to close its doors, laying off more than 4,000 workers. Youngstown was a steel town. During the first half of the 20th century, plants were booming. Youngstown was also a union town, a stronghold for the United Steelworkers by the 1940s. But by the 1970s, the once booming steel industry was going bust in Youngstown. More and more jobs moved overseas and to states with less union protections. Black Monday began a devastating series of plant closings. 2 years later, Briar Hill Mill closed, followed in 1980 by U.S. Steel. In 1985, it was Republic Steel's turn. By the early 1990s, the steel industry, which had once employed 40,000 people, only had 1,000 workers left in Youngstown. William Lawson, the executive director of the Mahoning Valley Historical Society, recalled the impact of the closings, saying, quote, "Over the course of my high school career, many boys and girls I had known in grade school left. Some in the middle of school years, most during the summers, as their parents accepted transfers to work in other plants around the country or lost their jobs and went out in search of employment elsewhere." In 1997, the Jeanette furnace at the shuttered Briar Hill plant was dynamited, despite preservationists' efforts to save it. Bringing down the Sweet Jenny furnace became symbol of Youngstown's economic ruin, memorialized in this Bruce Springsteen song.
Here in Youngstown.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Sweet Jenny, I'm sinking down. Here, darling, in Youngstown.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Just in time for Christmas, Marjorie Trainwreck Greene's going to have a new book out, a tell-all. She's going to settle some scores with an autobiography. They're saying this could pave her way for higher office, like vice president. And that is the right response. Oh, good God. Let's quick go to the phones. We got Steve from Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And I wanted to make a few points. And though I certainly agree that hypothetically China has the capacity to produce a large number of military vessels, in reality, that's something, again, that's only in a strictly hypothetical sense. In reality, about a third of their naval craft are strictly Coast Guard vehicles. They don't have the capacity to project them into sea. They're just, near shore vessels. Beyond that, what they do have is decades behind the United States as far as technology.
Right.
And not only that, but China does not have an experienced naval leadership. You know, they don't have it like the United States does, where you have people who are in their 50s and 60s who have decades of experience projecting American power on a global stage. China doesn't have one carrier group that can do that. We've got a dozen that can do that. One carrier group is an aircraft carrier. It's support ships. It means basically that the United States can project power that 95% of the world can't project in terms of its land and aircraft forces. And we can do that with one carrier group around the world. So people need to understand these distinctions. So it's not to say that we need to ignore China, but I seriously doubt with all of their concerns that they're going to invest heavily in terms of, you know, dedicating trillions upon trillions of dollars to build up a navy, as opposed to dealing with a lot of the crises that they're having to face now with regard to their economy and so forth, an aging demographic and so and other things. So, yeah, I mean, just as an aside, I mean, I could be wrong, but, you know, who knows?
Well, I'm just taking what the authors of this study are saying, this briefing. They're saying by 2035, China will have 475 battleships to our 305. If you're just looking at the numbers race, that's eye popping. But what it's telling me is they're moving towards wanting to compete, and that is a scary thing to me.
Oh no, and I agree that again, hypothetically, it's possible. Now, part of this, it's important to know because I'm familiar with part of this research, and a lot of that was put together prior to COVID in terms of what the agenda is for China. China is secretive about a lot of where it stands economically and so forth. And so in 2019, if you would have asked many economists in the world, well, where does China stand with regard to the United States? It was, oh, not a question of if, but when China will surpass the United States as the greatest economic power on the globe. Today, nobody's having that discussion. Today, it's, okay, is China just going to be as Japan was 30 years ago, someone that came close to our heels and then just faded into obscurity? Because there are so many challenges that China is facing currently. So this idea that they were going to be a rival to America and surpass us in terms of GDP, it's just, again, it's something in the rearview mirror. So, yeah, I mean, again, possible, yes, if the Chinese Communist Party decides that they want to allocate all of these resources to this. Likely, I don't think so, but that's where the debate lies. And I did call in to discuss this whole question of how we're going to deal with an ever-changing economy, because I agree with you. It's difficult. Unlike previous generations, you know, your grandparents' generation, your parents' generation, they got a gig maybe out of high school, maybe out of college, and 40 years ago they got a gold watch or a beer, depending upon your gig, and happy to have known you out the door.
And a defined
today,
benefit pension.
You're going to change career. Yeah, exactly. You're going to change careers two or three, four times, because that's the nature of how fast our economy is changing and that landscape is changing. And I sympathize with people because no one wants to be the 55-year-old guy who then has to learn the new trade and go out and find a new profession, because that means they have to start at the bottom. You know, it's like all of a sudden, okay, I've worked my way up to $150K a year. I've got two kids that are in college. I've got a mortgage, And somebody just told me that, you know, guess what? I'm obsolete. And I need to go in and start fresh. Can I start fresh at $40,000 a year, which is what somebody is offering me, to start in a new profession, to be retrained? And that's a question we need to ask ourselves. What are we going to do? Do we want to ask people to have to retrain themselves in middle age and 10 years from retirement and again, take a 80%, 70% cut in terms of salary and benefits? It's a difficult question. I think, you know, there is this notion in economics of creative destruction. So you destroy parts of an industry in order to build up other things. We destroy the horse and buggy industry. You used to employ huge numbers of people. Everybody had a horse, everybody had a buggy. That's how they got around in America. We invented the automobile. Some of those people transitioned into making carriages for automobiles, but most of them simply lost their jobs, and they had to move on to something else. Now the question is, at what cost progress? And I don't have the answer to that.
No, and this is where I think the UAW has taken the position that they want to ensure that those, that next generation of jobs are going to be UAW jobs and give, you know, their members an opportunity to train for those. I think that's a big part of what we're seeing. But I appreciate the thoughts, Steve. Good stuff as always.
Thank you.
You know, look, you know, that's the question. I've said from the beginning, you know, as AI comes on and robotics, you know, as a truck driver, you know, as someone who, you know, spent years in the trucking industry, when they finally do automate, and right now in California, there was a big rally today in Sacramento over AB 316 to ensure that when they do automate trucks, that there's someone at the wheel making sure that everything works. I've said there's either got to be that, a technology tax, something to ensure that.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap,
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.